On today's edition of the College Football Inquirer, we unpack Penn State's firing of James Franklin. This thing has a lot of tentacles that maybe reach all the way to Lincoln, Nebraska. Who knows? But there's also other jobs to consider. Meanwhile, has Texas Tech lapped the field in the Big 12? We'll talk about that as well. Plus, more firings in the Group of Five and a conference race in the American that could be epic. We'll talk about it all on today's College Football Inquirer. This is the College Football Inquirer. I am Andy Staples, here with Stephen Godfrey. Ross Dellinger, not here. This is Godfrey, where I would normally say Ross is on assignment, but it's not that Ross is on assignment. Ross cannot speak.
He's on IR.
Yeah.
It's a long season. It's a long season, and, you know, this is why we have a bench, which I guess is me.
Oh, and me. Yeah. I'm like the innings eater utility player. But Ross will be contributing to the show because we are going to talk about a story that Ross just dropped at Yahoo about the Big Ten private equity situation, where there's another school that may not be down with the whole private equity infusion that may be saying, oh, hold on a second, I don't know if we want to do this. Talk about that in a little bit, but we got to start in-state college. So we recorded the show on Sunday. We talked about James Franklin and the potential of firing. Then it happened. So I came back and talked a little bit about the immediacy and what happened that day. But we really need to unpack everything that's happened in state college in the last 3 weeks, because this is one of the most precipitous falls and one of the quickest triggers that I can remember.
It's definitely the quickest trigger that I can ever remember. In terms of, again, we said this on Sunday, so I don't want to belabor it. We were spending 15, 20 minutes of this program talking about how it's a drive away. It's a bad Drew Aller pick away. It was a tough decision that he forced one ball, and we could have beaten Oregon in overtime at home in a whiteout. And then
I thought you were talking about the Orange Bowl last year.
No, even more recent than that. I mean, this team yeah, was a national title contender coming out of the loss to Oregon. That was how we framed this up for our audience. We said that Penn State took a loss. It could spend a loss. It wasn't going to hurt them. They could have seen the Ducks again in the conference championship game. Mm-hmm. And then I still don't have context. And I was looking up other midseason firings or other preseason number one, number two, number three that have a total implosion like this. And you can't really find one that is this immediate, Andy. Now you can see, right, hey, we took one loss more than we thought we would, or we took the one loss that would knock us out of you know, BCS contention in that era. I've never seen in such short amount of time, two losses, 20 point plus favorites in both games. And then it's over. It's completely done. Also, we haven't really talked about the Aller injury and all this. Like, that sort of got swept away. Like, you're done.
Because I don't feel like it's relevant to the Franklin situation. It's obviously hugely relevant to Drew Aller and, you know, a guy who's probably an NFL draft prospect. I don't know how big of an NFL draft prospect now, but
yeah,
that also happened at the same time.
But if they had squeaked out a win, a sort of mercy win over Northwestern. They would have been without their quarterback. And then it's the sword of Damocles over Franklin for the rest of the way. So while it looks brutal,
I think Iowa would have put him out of the misery
yes,
this week.
So while it looks brutal, doing it now and losing to Northwestern was actually just, it was more efficient for Pat Kraft and company just to say, all right, we will deal with the ramifications on how astray the season got and how much money was spent and how it didn't work. We've got a year to talk about all that. For now, we are not going to belabor the point and let the conjecture build in a place where, famously, conjecture can build in a pretty toxic mm-hmm. way. We're done. We're over with it. So it's jarring on the outside. It's probably a nice example of the new way, the new way of doing business in this PE era.
Wow, I'm glad you mentioned the PE. That is something we'll be talking about with Ross's story. Don't know if Penn State needs it now. We do need to talk about the buyout. It is $48.6 million. The .6 is basically prorated part of the rest of this season. It's essentially $8 million a year through 2031. That's the buyout, how the buyout works. Unlike a lot of the contracts that we're going to talk about later in the season, Billy Napier, maybe Mark Stoops, maybe Brian Kelly, like any of those. There is what's called a duty to mitigate in this one, which means if you get another job and you are supposed to be trying to find another job, that the salary from that other job gets lopped off the buyout total. And I actually think James Franklin, there will be a market for him. I think there's probably, there's 100 schools in the country where I'd be comfortable with James Franklin coaching them and feel like they're in a good spot.
Yes.
And so I think James Franklin can get a $4 or $5 million a year job and turn this $8 million a year buyout into a $3 or $4 million a year buyout.
I'm not trying to stoke something that's not happening right now, but the place that felt the best for Franklin to land was actually North Carolina.
I agree. I agree.
It would have been perfect.
Virginia Tech could be the same. And that's open.
Yeah, I feel like I know James pretty well. I was around him a lot when he was coming up at Vanderbilt. I feel like his ability to play those rooms, the Argyle Illuminati in the Washington Post. He's exceptionally good at that, and I think he would also. I do think he would work the Jordan brand well. He's a guy who still likes to get out there and hype and do that kind of stuff. Tech is a little bit more workmanlike. You know, we could talk about that opening. Yes, he would do well there.
He can take a distressed asset.
Definitely.
And build up its talent level to the point where it is a formidable opponent. That's what they need.
He did that. I know what Vanderbilt is. We're going to talk about Vanderbilt in a second. He took a Vanderbilt where you did not have the luxuries that you have now in player acquisition and just strained and squeezed like the absolute limit of its potential to become technically a perennial bowl contender while he was there and beat big time programs, Auburn, Florida, Georgia. I mean, he pretty much clipped everybody at least once. I know he beat Ole Miss a couple years in a row when they were the permanent opponent. He took that thing to its absolute limit. So if you did bring him into, like you said, a distressed asset, especially in the ACC, I think you would see short-term results.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, it's kind of all we need right now. Is it short-term results? Like,
yes.
I am of the mind that if you can hire a coach who gives you 5 happy years, you've succeeded beyond your wildest imagination.
Could he, within the terms, and I don't have the contract in front of me, but mitigation is very interesting because I've heard of this from other coaches who have maybe walked into other situations and said, hey, you don't have to pay me that much right now.
Because, you are not supposed to do that. That got Brett Bielema sued by Arkansas.
Right.
But
that's where I was going.
If you do it in a kind of wink-wink and you don't overdo it, you don't say, I'll come be your head coach in the ACC for $1 million a year because that's not realistic.
But if
you said, I'll do it for 3.75.
Yes.
Normally they'd pay 7.
So if I'm in Blacksburg, right, and I'm getting this supposed $50 million cash infusion, sure would be nice in the immediate short term to lop off and get that number down to its absolutely most acceptable and then take that extra cash and start spending it on players, which is something Virginia Tech really hasn't done. That would be interesting. And also, James is that kind of petty and would absolutely do that in a heartbeat.
Also, that is the same recruiting footprint as Penn State. The recruiting footprints overlap pretty thoroughly there.
It's why Brent Pry got that job. It was one of the main things that Whit Babcock talked about when they hired him was how often Penn State was going all the way from Philadelphia down into the Raleigh, so like Central North Carolina area, and just owning all the Virginia schools on their own talent. They are not like the state of Virginia is not, Georgia or even North Carolina in terms of like total talent, but for Tech to be good or for UVA to be good, you have to be more competitive. And they were getting owned by Penn State for years.
So you've got that. Now at Penn State, you've got to find somebody who can do better than James Franklin. And I think that is the issue that you have, because you think about some of these other, like the comparison here, because of the size of the buyout, is always going to be to Texas A&M. And Texas A&M spent $77 million to fire Jimbo Fisher. They are happy they did that now. I am wearing my Snow's barbecue shirt for those who know ball in terms of that area of Texas. But Texas A&M did that and almost blew it. They almost blew it because they almost hired Mark Stoops. That was the initial choice. And then their board revolted and they went and got Mike Elko. So how do you make sure you get your Mike Elko at Penn State and not Mark Stoops? By the way, Mike Elko is probably somebody whose name will come up in that conversation.
It should.
Penn grad Mike Elko. Obviously, Matt Rhule is the first name that pops up because he was a walk-on linebacker under Joe Paterno at Penn State. Also, Penn State AD Pat Kraft served as the AD at Temple when Matt Rhule was the coach at Temple. They are very good friends, get along very well, and work together very well. But this feels like one of those that seems too obvious.
Yes, I would agree. I think there's two roads here in the conversations I've had early on in this process. It really will display where Penn State is at as a culture, more so than as a football program or a brand sort of testing its limitations as an absolute elite. Because that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about the fact that we were never Ohio State. We were never Michigan.
But you got to hire somebody to beat Ohio State and Michigan.
Sure.
Because that's what James Franklin didn't do. Like, Jimbo Fisher went 5-7 the year before he got fired at Texas A&M.
Yes.
James Franklin went 13-3 the year before he got fired.
If Matt Rhule is the hire, that is not necessarily a mark against Penn State. I'm more interested in, I'm always more interested in it's less about, oh, hey, this name's been announced, as I want to get on the phone and find out, well, what was the entire process like? How much of a consensus did we have? And was he the favorite? Like, was he the favorite from the pole position on, and we never really entertained anybody else? Because if we're just going to insert somebody who is an alumnus, who is a Joe guy, and it's going to make the Joe bots happy, it's going to call back to something that doesn't need to be called back to, not even from the political or ethical reasons, just because football's changed so much, then that's going to tell one kind of story about Penn State. They should go out. I think I use this phrase, I feel like, once a week on the show. So Penn State sets the market right now. They're the best available open job right now.
Yeah, and you know, Florida opens, maybe it's better, but I don't know if it is. I think Penn State is probably in line to be the best open job this year.
I think if you had to compare Penn State and Florida, it's more about what kind of luxury, like what amenities are you looking for in a luxury vehicle versus this one is empirically better than the other. But right now, you set the market. You should act accordingly. And you terminated him for a reason. You did it in such a short, compact amount of time, like we just talked about.
Yeah, I would take a big, big swing.
Go out and talk to the breadth of the possibilities. So, like, I've said this on the phone.
So what you're saying is talk to Marcus Freeman.
Talk to Tom Herman. Or talk to Tom Herman. God.
Tom. What year is this?
Dan Scott Lanning's Freeman. Face always makes me do that. I don't know. Like, I don't have face blindness, but I've done that 3 or 4 times talking about Dan Lanning where I see Tom Herman's face. I don't know why. I don't know.
They do have a similar, like,
I don't know who I'm insulting there, Andy. Like,
their smirk is very similar. Yes. But okay. Yes, you call Dan Lanning. Dan Lanning's not leaving, by the way.
You could call Tom. He'll probably talk to you.
You could call Tom, yeah. Yeah, but Dan Lanning's not leaving. Right. Marcus Freeman's not leaving either, but call him anyway.
Yes, I think it needs to get out there. And like, we're part of the cogs of this machine that I'm talking about. This is a little meta. Yeah. But I think it needs to get out there through the media that Penn State did have a cup of coffee, if you will, with someone that feels too big or feels immovable, right? Because Marcus Freeman is not going to leave South Bend to go to State College right now. But the
or Gainesville, by the way, that's another one that's probably going to call him.
But it's about creating the perception, because here's how you sell that. When you do hire Coach X in however many weeks, Andy, your fans, your boosters, your check writers are going to talk about this for 9 months and say, well, you know, they exhausted every option. They talked to everybody, right? They evaluated and they landed on this guy.
Can I throw another name out there for you?
What's that?
Kalen DeBoer.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Because Kalen DeBoer is the toast of Alabama right now. They love him. The black hoodie of death is the hottest piece of clothing in the Southeast. That said, if a 22-year-old misses a field goal and they lose to Tennessee this weekend,
yeah, they're dead.
It's right back, Andy, to where you were.
You and I are, I don't know what we are, young Gen X, I guess. We are old enough to remember a sitting Alabama head coach who was wanted saying, thanks, but no thanks, I'm going to go to a different job, right? It's been a long time, but Dennis Franchione said, I'm good.
They had probation coming. They had NCAA penalties coming, but sure. Yes.
But if you also have the perpetual threat of revolt in Tuscaloosa, which you do in such a bespoke way, where there's zero patience at all times and the looming specter of that man behind you, well, I mean, why not go to Happy Valley where, look, beating Georgia 2 years in a row.
Franklin already dealt with the looming specter of that.
He got that done for you. You know what, Andy? It's weird because there's a lot of similarities there for very, very, very different reasons. Franklin took care of kind of creating the time and doing the renovation post Joe Pa mess, right? Of course, there was an actual.
I mean, Bill O'Brien gets
there was
some
a football coach
too,
there before him, but yeah. They stretched that out. They dealt with the NCAA. They refortified scholarships and rosters and all that kind of stuff. You get to be the guy after the guy after the guy right now at Penn State in a big way. Whereas, like, that's what we always talked about with Alabama. And I thought it was like DeBoer had to have a certain kind of mental wiring to come in there and say, that's fine. I'll do this. I'll come in right after Nick Saban. Whereas a lot of candidates, that was a discussion when Saban retired, where a lot of leading names in this industry that maybe got sweet new contract extensions because of the conversation said, I would go to Alabama. I wouldn't go immediately right now. I'd wait for a guy to come in and let it get bumpy.
Right.
So maybe Kalen just
says, got to be the Ron Zook.
Yeah. And maybe Kalen just says, well, I don't want to be the guy fired. I came in here. I did this. What if he leads him to a playoff win, Andy? And it's like it's a technical success for everybody. And then he gets the hell out.
I think if he keeps winning, it's not going to matter because they're going to say, okay, you are equipped to compete in this era. And they start judging him on what he does. But again, back to Penn State, you call him no matter what.
Absolutely,
you just call him and say, what do you think? Because this is a job that could, I think a lot of coaches would really want this job. This is one we've always talked about. What would Matt Campbell leave Iowa State for? There are very few jobs he would leave Iowa State for. I imagine he would entertain this.
Definitely. I think the NFL would be a conversation there too for him.
I do too. But there is just, this is one, and I think we learned this in 2021 at the end of that season when Brian Kelly went to LSU and Lincoln Riley went to USC. No one is immovable.
No.
Everyone's movable.
It's been a little quiet relative to that. Those six schools rotating the coaches, I go back and I check in on it every 3-6 months and say, like, who's winning that, right? Like, and so far it looks like Miami and Oregon just won. They just had a no-fault divorce and everybody got better. But could it would not be a Brian Kelly to Happy Valley, but could it be to the benefit of Penn State to poach and make that the priority? To grab someone sitting from a place of, you know, perceived equal value.
Yeah, if it's Marcus Freeman, if it's Kalen DeBoer, I'm not sure there's anybody else that fits that profile. Obviously, you know, Eli Drinkwitz maybe. Lane Kiffin is already the name for a job that we think is going to come open.
Right.
That we believe is their top candidate. So yeah, I don't know. And I'm trying to think of who else really qualified. The thing is, and I was talking about this, my On3 co-host, Ari Wasserman, brought this up the other day. He said, remember in 2004 when it was obvious that everybody who had a job opening was going to go after Urban Meyer?
Sure.
And it ended up coming down to Florida and Notre Dame. And everyone knew that whoever got Urban Meyer was going to be successful and that it was going to work.
Right.
There's no one like that this year, and I'm not sure there's been anyone like that since where it felt, yeah, maybe say, I guess Saban when he got hired at Alabama. But there are very few situations where it's been, this guy is definitely going to be the guy. Because if we think about the people who've actually been the most successful over this time period other than Saban at Alabama, Dabo Swinney was the receivers coach / recruiting coordinator who was made the interim.
Right.
And didn't think he was even going to get the job. Kirby Smart was a great defensive coordinator, but you didn't know what he was going to be as a head coach. You didn't know how that would turn out. Ryan Day was the quarterback's coach / OC. Like, we didn't know with most of these people. So the fact of the matter is, the perfect person for the Penn State job might not be someone who's obvious. Might not be someone who is a sitting head coach right now.
Yeah.
Although that's probably who they're going to go after. But Marcus Freeman was the defensive coordinator at Notre Dame when Brian Kelly left.
And had not been there long. Had come over, was defensive coordinator at Cincinnati. So I think what you're getting at here is it's a little bit of angst on the buyer's part when you're making these decisions because it feels like we haven't caught up. The markets haven't caught up with each other. So what the coaching trees are developing and then what the sport needs. Saban's retirement kind of comes as a little bit of a delay into transfer portal, rev share, et cetera. And for a long time, Jimbo's a good example of this. We're still flushing either Saban clones or answers to Saban. Like Hugh, one of the big reasons Hugh Freeze got Auburn was he was considered to be a viable answer to Saban because he had beaten him in back-to-back years at Ole Miss, and that's very important on the Plains. I don't know if the market's caught up with the ideal coach to develop all the way to premier head coach for this style of college football.
Well, it's Dan Lanning. The answer is
correct.
You're looking for Dan Lanning.
Correct. Younger Tom Herman.
But who is that? And
but we don't have Schumann, we haven't made Dan Lanning yet. We haven't even opened the Dan Lanning
Glenn
factory.
Schumann's the DC at Georgia.
Yeah.
Came up in a similar way to Dan Lanning. I'd say Dan Lanning had a more diverse group of influences because Dan Lanning worked for Todd Graham and worked for Mike Norvell, but also had the little bit of Saban influence and then had Kirby Smart. Like Glenn Schumann has been a complete product of the Saban Kirby Smart machine. So, but we don't know what he'd be as a head coach.
Right.
And that's the trickiest part. Is you just don't like Will Stein?
That's where I was going to go.
Coordinator
next,
at Oregon,
yeah,
feels like the next guy who, when he gets that head coaching job, is going to be that guy. Interestingly enough, very diverse set of influences.
Yes,
because he played for the Brohm brothers at Louisville. He played for Charlie Strong at Louisville. He worked with Bobby Petrino at Louisville. He worked with Charlie Strong at Texas. He was a high school coach in Texas. He worked for Jeff Traylor at UTSA. Now he works for Dan Lanning. Like, he's had the breadth of experience that most of these guys haven't.
Is that the new tree then? Is it trying to be as multiversed as possible in the different aspects, regions, and statuses? Because these are guys who are a little bit of G5, a little bit of SEC. Yeah. Like,
I think geography matters less in this super premium type job.
Okay.
Because in the NIL era, you just go get the best players wherever they are.
We've nationalized the entire sport in a way that oh no, I don't want my kid to go to Oregon because I'm in Florida. Nobody has that conversation anymore.
Yeah. So if you're Penn State, like it used to be, how do you recruit the Northeast? How do you recruit the Eastern Seaboard? How do you recruit the DMV?
Well, let me stop you there.
I don't think that matters.
Let me stop you there because I just had three crooked fingers. Yep. That would be Fran Brown.
That would be Fran Brown. 100%.
That would be Fran Brown.
Now, here's the thing. Fran Brown might just be the next great head coach, period.
Yes.
Regardless of where his recruiting expertise lies, it just so happens to lie in the perfect place for Penn State. But if you talk to Fran Brown, you want to run through a freaking brick wall.
Yes, you do.
And you have seen him take teams with not as good of a talent at Syracuse so far and beat teams that are better. And what is the goal here at Penn State? Because you just spent a bunch of years where you beat all the teams you were more talented than, and the teams that were more talented beat you.
I want to come back to this this idea that you threw out because it's kind of clicked something in my brain. I don't think the timelines are. I feel like we're still incongruent right now, which is just a fancy word of saying like I don't think that the ideal model of coaching that you talked about, that 04 Meyer moment. Like, look, hey, John Summerall is a hell of a candidate right now, but that just feels like, hey, I've joked about this before, like, oh, we grew the perfect Auburn head coach in a lab, and here you go, Auburn.
But John Summerall, if we're going to make the Meyer comparisons, John Summerall actually
he's the closest.
Troy's Bowling Green,
yeah.
Tulane is Utah,
yes.
And then the next job is Florida.
And he has the SEC certification.
Except he's not getting hired at Florida.
He has that SEC certification that's mandatory. Yeah. To interview at these jobs because he was on Kentucky, he was on Ole Miss.
But Urban didn't have that. It didn't matter. He was just good.
No, and that was also in an era where scheme was a little bit more at the forefront of a resume. Now you're asked to be versatile in every scheme and almost to be agnostic to schematics and be asked to,
I think Elko's showing you that that's the way it's supposed to be done. Like, take what your players can do and maximize that.
If we don't have that Meyer moment, I really believe that Penn State will go and poach a name because there's still so much anxiety about the shifting landscape. We haven't settled on the identity of the sport for the future yet. And so the idea of investing in the Dan Lanning tree still feels probably too risky for such a financially consequential decision to be made.
If Will Stein gets an interview for some of these jobs, he'll be in it. Like, you talk to him. I'm just saying, he's one of those people, you talk to him for 5 minutes, you're like, oh, I'd follow you anywhere you want to go. Don't, like, that is, he's just that type of person.
But
Brandon Brown's that type of person.
But don't
too.
You feel like Will Stein still needs like the way Golish is sharpening his teeth at USF? Kind of, it doesn't have to be an American gig, but I mean, like,
did Kirby Smart need it?
Yeah, but Kirby Smart was like,
did Dan Lanning need it?
Kirby Smart was like the most famous guy in the Bain prison as a Saban assistant. Like, he was the only one who's like, I like it in the dark. I don't mind working for him.
Okay, Dan Lanning, did he need it?
I don't know if we're talking about models or outliers. That's the problem.
But that is the problem.
Or are outliers models? Maybe you have to do it that way.
Yeah, the problem with any of this is you're sort of putting yourself out there. It's like asking the prettiest girl in your school to prom when you know you may not have a chance. Like, you're probably going to crash and burn here.
Yeah,
like,
I would tell
Pat Kraft is. He has a great job to offer.
Yes.
But you have to get kind of lucky.
Look,
in this hire.
You're Penn State, the money, the resources, the positioning, the Big Ten affiliation. You're not, you're not president of the Magic the Gathering Club, maybe speaking from personal experience here. You're just the girl where they pull the ponytail off and they pull the glasses off and you're ready for prom. Okay.
You're Rachel Lee Cook and she's all that.
It doesn't take, it doesn't like shoot or shoot. And yeah, if we could all give advice to our past selves. Ask him out. Nothing truly damaging can happen if you don't ask. Penn State's going to be in a good position for now. until you and I are on microphones talking about the official opening in Gainesville or what's going on in Auburn or other schools that you and I have talked about off of microphones. Take advantage of being the market leader right now. That's what I would say. And just go pick up the phone. Call Andy Reid. Who cares? Just
that's a great idea.
I mean, just seriously. I don't know if it was, like, just
yeah.
If no, for no other reason,
I'm with you.
If for no other reason, let him give you. It's going to be Thanksgiving soon. He's got an amazing macaroni and cheese recipe. Like, maybe one of the best.
Awesome. I've ever seen. Okay. Now I'm going to have to do some Googling. All right. When we come back, we're going to talk about what happens elsewhere in the Big Ten as the Big Ten ponders a private equity infusion of cash. There's one more school that may be against it. And may hamstring the process. But also, I want you to know, if you want to watch the College Football Inquirer, if you enjoy listening, but say, what is that Snow's barbecue t-shirt that he's wearing actually look like? Well, you go to the Yahoo Sports Network. How do you find that? You turn on your smart TV. You find your Yahoo Sports icon on your home screen, free ad-supported television. That's what that is. And you click on it, and it's got all of the great Yahoo Sports Network shows. And also, if you'd like to watch on your phone, on your tablet, anywhere you are, any time of day, yahoosports.tv. yahoosports.tv. That is how you find the Yahoo Sports Network, and you can watch the College Football Inquirer anytime you want. So you can be watching when we come back and we talk about private equity in the Big Ten and the next school that may block the way. We are back at the College Football Inquirer, and while Ross is not here because his voice is not there, and listen, this is primarily an audio medium, Godfrey. You can't talk. You can't do it if you got no voice.
Yes.
I learned that the hard way when I was at SiriusXM, and you know, I'm one of those people, like, I go to work when I'm sick. I work. I don't take days off.
Right.
And I kind of sounded like this one time, and I did a show like that, and I got a call from my boss that said, I know you think if you don't come in or you call out sick that we'll fire you. Well, actually, we're more likely to fire you if you ever do a show like that again. So call us. If you have no voice, they're like, this is audio, buddy.
If you sound like hillbilly Darth Vader on AM radio. Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. So Ross very prudently called out today, but he did drop a great story. Like I said, Ross didn't stop and work it.
No.
So the story that Ross dropped on Tuesday morning is that USC now may be joining Michigan and Ohio State in opposition to this private equity deal in the Big Ten that would potentially bring $2.4 billion of cash to the Big Ten athletic departments. What makes this interesting, and so Ross had another story last Friday that we really didn't have time to get into on the Sunday show, obviously, because we were talking about games, but the source of the money on this deal is the University of California System's pension fund, which if I'm USC, the pension fund that represents UCLA,
yes,
providing all the cash would give me pause.
I have so many questions here. Like also one of the UC schools didn't make it. Like when you are maybe not.
Like UCLA is paying Cal because UCLA went to the Big Ten and Cal got left behind.
See, look, I don't want to get off track. The Big Ten is not the sole author of the demise of the Pac-12. If anything, that call might have been coming from inside the house. But damn, this is weird to come back to the UC system. That was my first question. Also, shout out, since he's not here. It is extremely my, let's call it stuff and keep it PG. It is extremely in my world when you start off a story and you're talking about something that happens on the field and then Ross pans out as a writer and says, the shadowy meetings in the Hollywood Hills, in the private homes, and in the luxury suites, because that's where I've loved to sort of operate in this business. And he's exactly right that what was going on, not that the game wasn't important, but what was going on here was dramatically more so. However, I want to play an idiot here, Andy, or just play myself.
I am an idiot, so I can help.
Okay. We both read this, which is a little bit like the smart kid in our class turning in his term paper first. And now we're trying to sort of like copy it a little bit to understand and extend to y'all. Ross mentions in here that certain schools will have a larger share than others. I had a question about that. Is that particular schools, or is this like
he mentioned that Friday as well.
Yeah.
And what I can't figure out is like what they are talking about independent of this deal.
Yes.
So independent of this deal, they're talking about uneven revenue sharing in the conference. This would be uneven distribution of this cash infusion. And so I don't think that necessarily tracks with the uneven revenue sharing, which the uneven revenue sharing is obviously going to be tilted toward Ohio State, Michigan, Penn State, the teams at the top.
He does outline
that.
Viewers. I was just curious if it is locked as being Michigan, Ohio State, and Penn State, because in here he has that in terms of the payouts of the uneven structure, according to those who have seen details of the plan. So I guess it is those three schools.
Yeah.
So if I am maybe not Rutgers, but I am semi-powerful, such as, for instance, a USC, which all joking aside, like USC and UCLA have some extremely influential, powerful, and rich people in and around those schools, like shout out to the Wassermans. Why am I touching? I'm not agreeing to this. This isn't happening.
Right. Well, and the other part that I found very interesting, so Michigan's Board of Regents is going to meet to talk about this. And Ross included in the story that Big Ten officials are stressing that this is a president's and chancellor's decision, not a board decision. Do the people in charge of the Big Ten not understand who employs the presidents and chancellors of universities? Like, the president of a university serves at the pleasure of the university's board.
Right.
That's the only people who could fire the president. So I realize that is coming in terms of Ross's sourcing and who he's talking to, that is coming from people who want this deal to go through.
Yeah.
But in reality, if Michigan's board doesn't want it, if USC's board doesn't want it, then the president of Michigan, the chancellor of USC, I think they call it a chancellor. They may call USC's a president too.
Okay.
But either way, it's the same. The CEO of the university is not going to defy the board to do this.
Is this not just a sort of, again, idiot talking? Is this not just a larger version of what's gone on in the ACC where it feels like, and again, it's hard because like we're not picking at Ross's sources or trying to out anybody. It's just that
right.
You have to always understand what information is coming out and why and from where and really build context.
What's the angle?
Yes. It feels very similar to I guess in the ACC, it's more the league itself, but this feels like there are some stakeholders here, individual schools that are saying, our goal is to lock in a grant of rights for an interminable amount of time, right?
They want security to 2046, which is what this would
do. And
we can name the schools, Rutgers, Maryland, Illinois, Minnesota.
And Minnesota kind of feels like the perfect protagonist here because Rutgers and Maryland, you know, they're come lately. They've always been the butt of the joke. They were created for a revenue model in Nielsen television ratings that don't really exist anymore. So glad you got out on the last train. Let's take Minnesota for a second. Let's just pick on the Gophers.
Yeah, we could throw Purdue in there if we wanted to.
I usually concept. I usually use Purdue, so I'll freshen it up. Shout out to the Gophers,
Minnesota.
I'm just willing immediately in negotiation to say Penn State, Ohio State, Michigan, you're going to be more successful than us by default. Here's more money to try and appease them, not to walk out.
I will do anything to stay in this room. Anything.
I just don't want you to leave for a pack of cigarettes. That's probably the biggest thing that we're doing here. You can continue to live better than me. You can continue to dominate us, but we need to stay in your, we need to be in your wake. We need to travel with you as a school. I was going for a fish metaphor there, sorry. But like we need to be connected to you in order to survive. This isn't, Andy, that dissimilar to all the bluster of a particular Texas Tech booster, right? Who's buying out television ads to basically say, hey, don't forget us, right? This is.
But do you know who is not part of that club? USC.
They're the full.
USC's not desperate to be loved by Ohio State and Michigan. USC, if USC were to go on their own, somebody'd be happy to take them.
Oh, everyone else would line up in a heartbeat. I don't know if the SEC would do it because they don't seem as interested in nationalizing the conference, but.
Trust me, if USC and Notre Dame were like, hey, would you like us to bring our rivalry to the SEC?
That pairing,
the SEC would be like, Southeastern, what? Yeah. Don't care. Come on.
Yeah, we'll kick out Missouri and Arkansas. To that end, yes, USC might be, God, am I about to say this, that USC might be the voice of reason here? That USC might be the, like, I've for two decades I've made fun of Heritage Hall's decision-making matrix, but I guess this might actually save them because they aren't as...
But it's an all politics or local thing because...
But what is
USC
local?
Well, your circumstances, not necessarily your geography. Because USC does not need Ohio State and Michigan and Penn State the way Illinois or Purdue or Minnesota needs them.
Yeah. So what you and I are saying is that USC, to some degree, the four West Coast schools, but most definitely USC being at the forefront of that, are saying, it's not three power holders and then everyone else who are just sort of rushing in as subservient. We have a different vantage point here financially. We don't need to acquiesce to you at every step. And I don't think they got into this for this kind of structure. Like if you assume, look, to some degree,
they wanted what the old Big Ten structure was.
Right.
That's what they were seeking.
Yes. Because everyone who jumped into a Power Two conference in this last round of realignment. So the Red River defection to the SEC and this West Coast move to the Big Ten, you were jumping off of something that was sinking at a differing speeds. So you were a sort of a refugee in that way. But it's not like USC came on as a castaway. They had equity. They had power. And maybe even more.
USC wasn't on a lifeboat. No. USC had a hydrofoil stashed at the bottom of the cruise ship.
Yes.
And it just powered its way
out.
They
didn't walk into the Big Ten saying thank you exclusively. They wanted to be able to set up stakes and thrive. And this, if I'm reading the sort of the unnamed sourcing part of Ross's story, is saying, hey, hang on a second. We don't just have to bow down. I don't know, Andy, though, to push this conversation forward. I don't know how much of this new power dynamic works over time, because this entire league has always existed with those two or three schools when Penn State joined, setting the terms of the conversation. Like, are they going to build out? It doesn't make sense. Okay, let's go back to Minnesota and Purdue. You don't want USC to upset this, right? You don't want them to object. Mm-mm. If anything, you want them to fall in line with you.
Yeah. Well, and I want to go back to our friend Matt Brown, the Extra Points newsletter. I know a lot of the people who listen to this show probably subscribe to Extra Points as well. Matt does a great job of examining the inner workings of college sports. When the news of this first came out, when the ESPN story first came out a few weeks ago, Matt had a great newsletter the next day where he basically posed the same question over and over. Why are you doing this? What do you need this money for? What are you using this money for? Because usually if you take a PE, if you take a PE deal and you take a cash infusion from a private equity firm, it is to grow something, to scale something, to change something, to make it bigger. And it feels like some of these schools are doing this to pay their bills or to pay bills that they assume are going to come due. That is not why you do this. So why are they doing this? Godfrey, you hit it. You said exactly why they're doing this. They're doing this to get to 2046 instead of 2030.
But that's not a growth
plan. TV deal ends in 2030. It's not a growth plan. So, it's a cling plan. It's a hang on by the skin of your teeth plan.
And if you keep operating that way, then when the bill comes due, private equity is not free money. You have to, like, the reason why you take PE for growth is the idea is that your revenue will increase so you can pay them back with interest. That's the point of this thing.
This is more of an MMR deal than a private equity deal. And I know a lot of people listening who work in college athletic departments know what an MMR deal is. For those who don't, it is essentially you sell your marketing rights to a firm that guarantees you X number of dollars per year. They then turn around and sell your marketing rights themselves. They keep anything over the cap. Now, there's probably a commission fee where if they go over what they're paying you, they give you a percentage and they keep a percentage.
Okay.
But this is the Learfield deal. This is the Playfly deal at your favorite school. That's what this is. It's not, you're not selling necessarily a piece of the physical property.
Right.
What the Big Ten is actually selling is a 5% stake. It's a 1/20th share because it's 18 schools and then the conference office is the 19th share. The 20th share is the people who infuse the cash.
Okay.
So the 20th share is you get 5% of all of the revenues that are generated by the conference office.
Okay.
Which, by the way, is the TV deal. So that's the biggest revenue generator the conference has.
Okay. So can I ask? So if I'm following you, then the long-term goal then is to sort of push the value of the media rights to a higher number.
To where that 5%, you're willing to give that away because you are making significantly more. It's sort of like, it's almost like, you know, for personal purposes, if you hire an agent.
But
an agent's taking 10%.
But how is this going
to... That agent better get you 10% more than you were already making.
Absolutely. Mine did. Good job. But here's the problem. If you do it this way, idiot talking, you're not going to increase the Purdue and the Minnesota value any more in proportion than you are just going to continue to increase the value of, like...
But they are not worried about their value increasing. They are worried about staying alive in the club.
But here's where I'm headed, because you got me. All right, that was the next step, and here's the final one.
Yep.
If I'm one of the Goliaths, if I'm one of the brand names, this is a dumb proposition.
Why do I need to do this?
I don't need to keep you alive for 20 years. Because we're going to take on this PE. We're going to pay it back. Our value at Penn State or Ohio State or USC is going to go up. And yours might incrementally, Purdue or Minnesota. But we could also find a deal on our own that does everything that we just said without even having to bother with you while allowing ourselves more freedom, right? To go out and strike deals in 5 or 10 years. Maybe we're doing some sort of super conference matchups with the SEC. Remember that was talked about last year of a separate TV contract between the mega powers of both schools to have almost like a tip-off classic sort of version in football. Why not leave the door open for monumental billion-dollar deals? Because it's like every segment we do at Ohio State, I should be having these conversations over a cup of coffee in Tuscaloosa or in Gainesville. Or in Los Angeles, but I don't really need to bring you to the table at all, Purdue.
Exactly.
Okay. So nothing changed.
So if we're asking, Matt Brown's question, why are they doing this?
Yeah.
That's why they're
survival.
Doing this.
Survival. Yes. Yes. I just don't see the incentive if I'm...
Ones that don't need this for survival, they're not stupid.
And they should say no. And I know that's cruel because, like, again, I love G5 and small schools and stuff, but like, it does not make financial sense. This is not a charity. It never has been. Look around. College football is a business.
Yeah. It ain't show friends. It ain't show family. It's show business. When we come back, Godfrey, you mentioned a certain billionaire in Texas funding a roster.
Doing a good job.
Guess what? It worked.
Yeah. Real.
We'll talk about how Texas Tech
good.
Has lapped the field, apparently, in the Big 12. Also, the American race is going to be a banger the rest of the way. We'll talk about that when we come back. We're back at the College Football Inquirer, and Godfrey, during the last segment, we obliquely mentioned a certain oil and gas billionaire who's a former Texas Tech offensive lineman who has helped fund a roster at Texas Tech. And we wondered how this great experiment would go. I am comfortable at this point in the season declaring it a success. Now, maybe I'm being premature because Texas Tech is only 6-0 and they're obviously 12 games in a regular season.
Yes.
But I feel very confident that Texas Tech will be favored by double digits in all but one of its remaining games. That would be the BYU game on November 8th is the one I don't think they'll be favored by double digits. And I think they will win by double digits in all of their remaining games because they are so much better and so much more talented than the other teams in the Big 12.
I try to not feel redundant on the show. And I come back to like the same handful of talking points, no matter what the subject matter is. When you have a roster and you have really good lines and you have a really good front seven on defense, I don't care what league you play in. I don't care how storied the program is. I don't care how smart the coach is. Chances are you're going to be really good at the winning football games part of this. So I cast the net out to our friend Parker Fleming, Stats of War on Twitter, on his social media. You can check him out. He does advanced analytics. And what I often do, much like with Ross's work, is I just say, all right, okay, I'm gonna look on the paper somebody smarter than me because I know what I'm seeing when I watch Texas Tech play, but I may not know how to distill it or understand it. So I went in there and asked the people who didn't fail math in college like me, of all the stats that Parker gave me, Andy, for Texas Tech football, they are first in the nation in yards after contact allowed on running the ball. That, well, like,
Cameron Dickey ran for 263 yards on how many carries the other day? It was obscene. 21 carries for 263 yards.
No, I'm saying their defense.
Oh, their defense. Oh, in terms their of defense, they don't allow any. Yeah, they don't allow any yards after contact.
Their front on yards after contact on opponents running the ball. I don't know if I ever thought I would ever say that about Texas Tech. And that's not a knock on the air raid or the tree or the philosophy or what it has been, but we can say with some authority that the last sort of big 12 was defined by the Texas air raid and not running the ball and having pointsy offenses and being light in the ass on defense and allowing things and basically last possession wins was sort of the culture of that league, and no program personified that more than Texas Tech. And this defense,
You mean the team that had Patrick Mahomes as the quarterback yet couldn't win consistently?
Because yeah, they were. It was 800 yards of offense, but it was 770 allowed on defense or 850 allowed on defense. And now you are seeing, because by the way, they're still running those principles on offense. They're still passing to set up the run because they look so good passing that they've been able to get guys, spread guys out and create light boxes. They're running the ball pretty well. So, but that philosophy is still in play. Going out, it's this simple, Andy. I don't want to take anything away from the coaching staff or the acumen, I guess, but like they're a really good defense. They can hang with, like, they will go into the playoff and not look outmatched the way like an SMU did.
Right. And some of that is Joey McGuire's recruiting because a lot of these guys are homegrown.
Yeah.
But some of that is Cody Campbell and his funding of a roster that they went in the transfer portal and competed with schools that Texas Tech normally does not compete with for players.
Because you keep them and you recruit them in the portal. But the keeping them part doesn't get as much publicity. It did in the case of Penn State, but normally we talk about what you got out of the portal. But coaches, when I do like...
Well, we expect a Penn State to keep its good players.
Sure, sure.
We don't expect Texas Tech when they have a good linebacker who develops their...
Right.
We figure Georgia's going to steal them.
Yes.
But it's not working that way.
They kept everybody they wanted to. They've developed well. Obviously, he has the contacts in Texas. And they went out and shopped akin to, you know, Florida State a couple years ago. It's working. It's great. Like, this is, relative to the rest of the league, is there any kind of bump left? Because I love...
BYU. BYU's the bump.
Okay.
And
I was going to say, I love Arizona State, but not this roster at Arizona State.
So Arizona State, they're playing this week, and that's the best example, and this is why I brought this up today. So they're playing Arizona State, which won the league last year, has a great quarterback in Sam Leavitt, who we don't know if he's going to play this week. And this is all you need to know. If Jeff Sims starts a quarterback for Arizona State against Texas Tech,
yes,
Arizona State has no chance to win. If Sam Leavitt starts, Arizona State has some chance to win, but probably not much. Meanwhile, Texas Tech has its own quarterback injury issues. But here's the thing. Whether Baron Morton or Will Hammond starts is irrelevant.
It doesn't matter.
They have an equal chance of dominating either way.
No, look at the Utah game. I mean, the Utah game is the best example of this, and I think that's close to a comp in terms of the opponent. I used to be on a text chain with a couple of our colleagues and mutual friends, and they would always roll their eyes when you would see 7-year, 8-year quarterback starter floating around their third job, and I would always defend that as like, hey, let that kid make a little bit of money before he goes in the real world. Mm-hmm. Jeff Sims, why don't you get on that LinkedIn, buddy? It's about time to update that LinkedIn. We don't need to be doing this anymore.
This is it. This is the end.
Yeah, we don't need to be doing this anymore.
Jeff Sims was a true freshman in 2020. I watched him in his first game ever at Florida State. 25% capacity at Doak Campbell Stadium. He was playing for Georgia Tech. Beat them. It feels like a billion years
ago. Yeah, I was going to say, it feels like a legit decade that you're talking about. Part of that's COVID. No, I don't see any roadblocks. If I'm in the, like, you put out a bracket every Sunday night, right? Mm-hmm.
Yep.
That's got to be the most comfortable of the 12.
I'm moving Texas Tech up because, you know, the assumption was that the Big 12 champ will be the 10 seed or the 11 seed because they're just not going to, you're not going to feel like that they can compete with the best of the Big 10 and the SEC.
Yeah.
The way Texas Tech is playing, they look like they can. Like, if they keep winning, they're going to be a top 4 seed.
Also, the BYU game's at home, which is a big deal because BYU and Utah, I don't know if they, I know we sports writers give this a lot of praise and play, but nationally, I don't think people realize how hard those environments are to play in, but it's at home. And, you know, they can, again, you can spend a loss because you're probably going to be in the Big 12 championship. They don't see Iowa State, which isn't that big a deal now. So, yeah, this is probably the cleanest and easiest path of anybody to a championship. If you would like to transition, I'm going to try one out. If you're looking for a path to a championship that's clouded, but filled with intrigue and potentially very good football, that would be...
And a path to the playoff, too. Let's not forget
without a doubt. Yes, with all due respect to the fight in Dan Mullins in Las Vegas, and maybe that's probably it, the winner of the Americans going to the playoff this year. And the problem is, right now, you have 4 teams who are undefeated in conference play, and I could toss it up between any one of the 4, depending on how I feel. Navy, probably the weakest option there, probably.
Well, let's name the 4.
Navy.
South Memphis.
Florida. Yeah, sorry. Navy, Memphis, US, South Florida, and Tulane.
Tulane, yes. Yeah.
So I would say Navy come from behind victory over Temple last weekend. I think I'm not trying to disparage the troops, but for a second, let's just talk about South Florida and Tulane and Memphis. Memphis has the best... looking at slash hardest American schedule left, but because of what South Florida did against the Gators, if Florida can keep going a little bit, then that may be the best resume win because Memphis is Arkansas,
right? And Arkansas is not, even though Bobby Petrino, you know, had him playing tough against Tennessee.
Yeah,
Arkansas's schedule is absolutely brutal.
Right,
Florida, we'll see what happens because they're probably going to make a change too. So their schedule's tough as well. I don't know how much difference that's going to make, but I think the fact that you have, because you're dealing with the committee, you do have all these coaches saying that they feel like Florida's incredibly talented. I think the people in the committee room will say, okay, USF's win against that team probably holds more value than Memphis's win against Arkansas.
Yes.
Although I will say Tulane's win against Duke,
It's not bad.
Maybe the might wind up looking like the best of the bunch by the end.
Right. So I'm doing this on the fly. It's a little confusing because the league, it's not round robin. But
no.
So if you're USF, you have a loss, but it's to Miami and you have a win over Florida. You also beat the
loss to Miami is erased by the win.
It doesn't matter at all. You also beat the brakes off of Boise. We'll see what that actually returns down the stretch. If you're USF, you have Memphis and Navy. I think you can control your destiny. Okay. If you're Memphis, like you said, we beat Arkansas, we're feeling good. They have the toughest stretch because they still have home against South Florida, Tulane at home, and then they end the season, I think on Thanksgiving night, against Navy.
Against Navy.
So you could play in based on the quality of your American opponents. If you're Navy, you probably need to run the clean sheet because you don't really have any kind of tent pole behind you.
But that means you got to beat Notre Dame.
Yes. And this is where I feel like it gets hard for Navy. Again, it's not me disparaging the troops. It's just that you're going to go in an extreme underdog. They have won there before. I've seen it in the Ken Niumatalolo era. But those were different Notre Dame teams. One of the things that Marcus Freeman's done a really good job of, because they played Army in the regular season, and they keep the perpetual contract with Navy. If you don't know why, check your World War II history. They play the triple option team so much better than Brian Kelly ever did.
You know why? Because they have way better athletes.
You know what? I didn't know if you were going to go for analysis or glib, but that's I'll let you get that one. Yeah.
No, I mean, I agree. Listen,
it's because they're better.
My son is a center in a triple option offense. I can give you the X's and O's of why they're hard to stop and why defensively you have to make sure everybody plays their assignment perfectly on every play.
Yeah.
But that's not even it, because there is one way to stop a triple option offense if everybody's not perfect every play, and that is you are overwhelmingly more athletic.
Yeah.
Like if you can throw the left, if you have a D tackle who can throw the left guard into the mesh every play, that offense can't do anything.
The other problem for Navy is this. And by the way, I'm not writing UNT off, North Texas off completely. It's just that it's very crowded. You have less.
After what we saw, it's hard to.
They're second tier. And I think they're on the right path. And I really like Eric Morris. They're just not in this group right now. So you still have North Texas on the road. You have the Notre Dame game we talked about. You have South Florida, Memphis, and you close against Army. That's the hardest road to travel. And again, you looked shaky against Temple. So I really feel like it's a three-team race here, Andy. And I definitely feel like if UNLV runs it, like if UNLV is undefeated, I still don't know if they could beat out one of these resumes, the eventual American champion.
I would agree with that. And it's interesting because UNLV has the win against UCLA, which I don't know how you view that as the committee, because if Tim Skipper keeps doing what he's doing at UCLA, they might have a better record than we ever imagined. Now, the rest of their schedule is actually extremely hard. So
normally,
maybe that they don't win much more.
I always make fun of those, like, we did the simulated committee, and you know the committee does a good job on putting out PR about how tough it is to be on the committee.
Yeah.
So I don't take a lot of interest in that, but I am curious, does the committee discern between one UCLA? Right,
a win against Deshaun Watson UCLA and a win against Tim Skipper UCLA would be very different things.
That's where I'm going.
But that's not Dan Mullen's fault. You don't play him when they play him.
No doubt. Yeah. I mean, like you win all your games, you know, I'm on team put Florida State in the 4-team playoff. Like, I'm not sliding them. I'm just saying that the depth of these schedules in the American, combined with a couple of these teams' ability to boast out of conference wins of quality, like beating Florida, beating Arkansas, et cetera, like, to me, that outweighs the resume.
Oh, by the way, Tulane's winning against Northwestern, looking pretty sweet now.
Yeah. You know what? I didn't think about that one. Like, that's not bad. Tulane's
And they beat Duke, and Duke is favored against Georgia Tech this weekend. And like, if Duke beats Georgia Tech this weekend, Duke in the ACC championship game is not outside the realm of possibility.
Only problem here is that you have to beat Memphis, obviously, if you're Tulane. But you got to run a really clean sheet, because you get a lot of the weaker teams. UTSA is on a down year.
You don't have the difficulty level of Memphis and USF in the conference
but
schedule.
But you have for as much as this might matter, and this is where I think it just comes down to the subjectivity of the room, your loss is a quality one. You lost by 35, but you lost at Ole Miss, who right now is in the playoff as well. This is why I love the playoff era, Andy. This is me being positive once a week, baby.
It's fun.
We are talking about so many teams in the group of five who you have to pay attention to if you're a college football fan, because somebody in the five slot is going to have a hell of a day. This is going to be the 12. I'm not crazy. This is going to be the 12 slot team for sure. Mm-hmm. But somebody in the five coming off of potentially a loss in a conference championship game in either Atlanta or Indianapolis is going to have a fight on their hands, because I think these lines are better than Boise's last year. And it won't be a second round game, right?
This is where changing the seeding rules also changes things, because the five with the rules in place last year is probably the actual third best team in the country.
Yes.
And in this case, the five is the fifth best team in the country. So like this 12 having to play the third best team in the country, you don't feel as good about. Like if they had to play, if they wind up having to play Miami or the SEC champion. Or, well, it wouldn't be the SEC champ, or the second best SEC team, or the second best Big Ten team.
Yes.
Like you wouldn't want that. You may play the second best SEC or Big Ten team, but that's where they fall, not that's where they got knocked down to.
And this is why I begged, not that anyone's going to listen, let's hang with 12 for a second and try and tweak it rather than blow it all up, because the best team in the country, bar none, was playing in the first weekend. We just we had an extremely weird thing happen where they lost to their arch rival and got knocked out of the conference championship.
And they still would have been playing in the first weekend. They would have been the sixth seed.
I'm saying had Ohio State not. So basically, if Ohio State does, if they can kick a field goal, or if they can put a touchdown up against Michigan, I think the matchups look so much different. And then I'm not going to argue that, like, I love the G5, but Boise should be on the first weekend.
They shouldn't be on the second weekend or the second round, I should say, not the second weekend.
Well, and they have a better chance of winning in the first weekend.
And it's more important for the G5 to win a playoff game than to start that road later on in the bracket. Mm-hmm. That's the legitimacy that you're actually seeking, is the winning the one game.
Yep. Godfrey, this is going to be so much fun. We have a lot of games to talk about on Thursday. Yes. Ole Miss, Georgia is one that I am very interested in previewing. I know you've gotten some advanced stats stuff for that. Ross should be back. We can quiz him on the PE stuff and figure out where we got it wrong, where we got it right.
Yeah, we can get grades. But we can get grades for our segment today.
Yeah. Ross, I want you to listen and let us know where we screwed up. But a lot of fun. A lot coming up this week. Big slate, tons of storylines, potential job openings coming up next week. This is probably the juiciest portion of the football season so far, and it's only going to get juicy from here. We'll talk to you on Thursday.